For the week of August 28th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 116, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the wreckage of Hurricane Irene, I'm Michael Giltz.
So how was Hurricane Irene? I guess you're in New York.
I'm mopping out my basement. I have all my media center, my media empire is in two storage lockers in the basement of my four-story building. And I have all my DVDs and books down there, a lot of them, I should say. So I had to bring them all up to my ground floor apartment, keep them up off the floor in case there was flooding down the street. And so that was good because there was flooding in my basement. I'm still mopping it out. You know, I grew up in Florida and I was born in Bermuda, so I'm used to hurricanes. And it's true. Most of the time, you know, when you do have to prepare and you do have to step away and, you know, evacuate, turns out they, you know, veer off in another direction or they weaken and they're not as big a deal. But, you know, that's what you have to do. You can't, you know, you can't guess which time it's going to be the killer and which time it's going to be a Hurricane Andrew or Katrina and, you know, kill people and which time it's going to weaken.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. You know, having experienced Hurricane Andrew in Florida, it's not
That was a disaster. I forget how many homes were destroyed, but that was a real, real hurricane. Yeah.
Well, certainly the hurricane did some damage to the box office, which we'll...
Yes, let's get to the important things.
Yes, the news. Yes.
I saw the Hollywood Reporter like headline. I'm cleaning out my house. I'm running through and I get a thing on my phone on the email saying, box office may be weakened by Hurricane Irene. I'm like, yes, they have their eye focused on what matters.
Right. Well, and so do we, at least for this particular show. And on this show, we'll be talking about what Steve Jobs' resignation as the CEO of Apple means to the entertainment industry. At least we'll try. Over in the world of television, one of the husbands on The Real Wives of Beverly Hills committed suicide, causing Bravo to re-edit episodes for the upcoming season. We have some listener voicemails and emails to wrap up the show. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
So before we get to the worldwide box office, I wanted to concentrate for a second on North America. We were off last week pretending to be French. You know, it is August.
That's right. And that's so, why we don't have a guest, as a matter of fact, because everybody's out of town.
And Hurricane Irene.
Yeah, that's true.
And so six movies have opened up last weekend and this weekend. All six have flopped. Let's just cover them briefly. These are all six movies that opened in North America and mostly nowhere else in the world yet. So last week, three movies opened. Spy Kids, All the Time in the World, the fifth in the franchise. Conan the Barbarian, a reboot of the Conan franchise, and Fright Night, a remake of the 80s cult vampire movie. All three flopped. Spy Kids has made $21 million so far on a budget of $27 million. Fright Night has made $14 million on a budget of $30 million. Conan is the big story. It has grossed $16 million so far in North America on a budget of $90 million. It's a terrible movie. They're all bad. But this movie got horrible reviews. People just stayed away in droves. I saw it at a screening in 3D. It is an insult to say that this movie is in 3D. It's not that the 3D is done poorly like in Clash of the Titans. It literally doesn't exist. There is no 3D. They don't even throw a spear at you. And yet you're forced to wear the bulky glasses and pay extra to see the movie. It really is just... I mean, I can't imagine anyone who did dumb enough to see the movie would already be angry, but then to pay extra for 3D, it's literally an insult. So those are the three movies from last weekend. This weekend, we had three more films. Columbiana, starring Zoe Saldana of Star Trek and Avatar, of course. That grossed $10.3 million. Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, a fairly anonymous horror film presented by Guillermo del Toro. That grossed $8.6 million. And Our Idiot Brother, starring Paul Rudd, who I love, got terrible reviews and grossed $6.5 million. None of them are expensive. And in fact, Our Idiot Brother cost $5 million to make. I think it was a film festival pickup.
Yes, it was.
None of them are going to make anybody rich. So that's six films in 2 weeks released in North America. All of them did poorly. The only really big news in North America is The Help.
That's right. That's amazing how well that movie's been doing.
Absolutely. It's grossed $14.3 million this weekend. Still number one at the box office for the third. Was it number one its opening weekend? I forget now.
I don't think so.
That's right. Something else came in like Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
So it's at $14.3 million. It's grossed $96 million so far in North America. The next big question is how will it do overseas? Because so often movies with major black stars in the roles, especially dramas or romantic comedies, they don't even release them overseas.
Well, it's also a very American subject.
Race? I'm pretty sure people are familiar with race in England and France and Germany and Spain.
Race during the early 1960s in
You know, anything well done is universal, is my mind. That's how I feel about it. The idea that these movies don't travel, I think, is insulting and stupid. You've got a huge worldwide audience. If it's a good movie, you can sell it. But Hollywood doesn't even release the Tyler Perry movies overseas, to put it in context. One of the most, you know, successful dollar-for-dollar filmmakers of the last decade. They don't even bother to put his films out overseas.
I can tell you that The Help, DreamWorks is thanking their lucky stars for The Help, because I talked to somebody over there who's, well, I probably shouldn't say their name, but they're very high up, let's put it that way, and they're getting slaughtered on Cowboys and Aliens. They spent, you know, close to $300 million making and marketing that movie, and it's made $129 million to date worldwide. Not just in North America, but worldwide. And it hasn't opened completely yet, but, I mean, it's just taking a bath. They're going to lose their shirt on this.
Well, yeah, they're gonna lose a couple $100 million. That's what happens sometimes. It was a difficult property to sell. All the elements were right. It was based on a comic book. You had Jon Favreau directing. He'd done Iron Man, also a not well-known comic book. Stars Harrison Ford and Daniel Craig. So it's what happens. But it's one of those films that people literally just stayed away from the second it opened. It wasn't like people went and didn't like it. They didn't like it before it even opened.
Yeah, well, this particular person was telling me that they did not want to do either The Help or Cowboys and Aliens, and they were right on Cowboys and Aliens, and they were admittedly wrong on The Help, because they said it's not going to do anything foreign.
Who's they? That person or the studio?
This particular person who is a...
No, I meant, were they speaking for themselves or the studio was reluctant?
Themselves.
Yeah. Well, that was stupid on The Help, because they made it for $25 million. It sold millions of copies as a bestseller in the U.S., it's a good roll of the dice just based on North American box office alone. You can imagine you could make, on a reasonable scenario, that you might make $40, $50 million on this movie. You know, it's a lot of good sized names in it. It's a very popular book. You're going to get the women into the movie. So I think that was a good roll of the dice, even if you figure you're not going to make a penny overseas. But it's an Oscar hopeful now, seriously.
Yes.
Certainly for some of the performers, like Bryce Dallas Howard as the racist. It's going to be something that they should present as a prestige picture and try and launch overseas. I suppose they'll use more of the white women in the posters.
Yeah, maybe.
But there you go. So that is the North American box office. And the worldwide box office is a little bit different. The number one movie at the box office over the weekend was The Smurfs, which grossed $30 million. Number two worldwide is Rise of the Planet of the Apes. That grossed $28 million. Final Destination 5 grossed $23 million. Cowboys and Aliens is still making money. It grossed $16.4 million. But as you said, it's at about $130 million worldwide to date. Number 5 is The Help, which based on its North American gross alone at $14.3 million comes in at number 5. Number 6 is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, another $12 million. That's at $1.294 billion worldwide to date. It is officially the third highest grossing film of all time. It's behind Titanic, which grossed $1.8 million, and Avatar, which grossed $2.7 million.
You mean billion, I would assume.
Billion.
Yes. Billion with a B.
In the last 2 weeks, I've been sick. I'm still sick. I've had an earthquake. I've had a hurricane. I've had floods.
I know. All you need is tornadoes and tsunamis, and you've hit, like, you know,
we had tornado warnings.
Yeah, that's true.
I feel very biblical right now. And number 7 worldwide is Cars 2, which grossed another $11.5 million. That's at $500 million worldwide and counting.
So I would assume they're thinking this is a success.
Well, no. It cost $200 million to make. They probably spent, you know, $150 million at least to market it. So I would not call it a rousing success. It's still one of the lowest Pixar films of the past decade. It's still got to be disappointing, especially given the amount of love that the first film had from little children and the amount of, you know, merchandise it sold. You would have thought there was this pent-up demand for Cars 2, and it just isn't the case.
Right.
And then number 8, Colombiana, based on this North American gross. Number 9, Kung Fu Panda 2, $9.1 million. It's like $637 million worldwide, more than the original. And yes, I would say that is a success. And number 10, of course, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Which, at 8.6, which it made here in the U.S.
That's right.
I'm surprised. Horrible Bosses, still making money overseas, $8.1 million, $170 million that movie has made to date, 113 of that here in the U.S. Green Lantern, that's kind of a bit of a dud, $206 million worldwide to date.
Yeah, it's a dud because it costs a lot of money to make, where Horrible Bosses was a very inexpensive movie, and that's proven a huge success story.
But I think we can almost guarantee we will see a sequel to The Smurfs. It's made It's made $382 million worldwide to date.
Well, I would think you would. I believe they have a script in the works already. That's what they like to do now. They say, oh, we're considering a sequel. They want you to go to the opening weekend thinking, oh, this movie is so good, it's going to have a sequel. And they think that's some sort of draw to go see a movie. And I think they announced that they're working on a sequel script. It cost $110 million to make. It probably costs a lot to market. So they're probably around the break-even point. But it's making some money and there'll be DVD. But I'm not sure whether they'll think they've dodged a bullet because it was so bad or whether they think, we should make a sequel. If they can keep the cost down, I guess maybe they will.
Yeah, Alvin and the Chipmunks, that had a sequel.
But that made a lot of money. That's did a lot true. Better.
Yeah, and it wasn't as critically panned as the Smurfs was.
It certainly wasn't loved. But there were worse things in the world than seeing Jason Lee hang around with chipmunks.
Well, here in the U.S. over the weekend, it was the second slowest weekend of the year thanks to Hurricane Irene. I guess they're predicting or estimating that the industry lost around $25 million in box office. And you mentioned how bad Conan was. Well, it dropped 70% at the box office week over week, so you're right there. But
from a very low opening.
That's right. And then Midnight in Paris passed $50 million this weekend, and it's going to get a broader opening in the fall because they couldn't get enough screens during the summer, so it's going to come back to theaters here in the U.S.
That's right. They think there's more money to be made. It's already his highest grossing movie in North America.
And by he, we mean Woody Allen.
Woody Allen, yeah. And they're going to release it again in the fall. I saw that like a week and a half ago, but that was really interesting. I guess if you can get the screens, they've already spent the prints, they just run some newspaper ads and a few TV ads, and you're back good to go.
Yeah, and they probably don't even need to run any marketing at all because word of mouth will probably bring people to the few theaters that are going to be showing it. And Bridesmaids, that surpassed $100 million overseas, and we always talk about how comedies don't play well overseas. $100 million is nothing to sneeze at.
That's right. There's certain to be a sequel to Bridesmaids. But what astonishes me is that there's going to be a sequel to Blade Runner.
Yeah, this news was almost disturbing. I guess it was announced a week and a half ago or a week or so ago that Ridley Scott is, he's already doing a sequel to Alien or a prequel to Alien, which is one of his big sci-fi movies. He then made Blade Runner, I think a few years, like 1981, and Alien was 1977. So
No. Blade Runner's 82.
Oh, 82. Okay.
I believe Alien was 79, wasn't it?
70. Okay. Yes, you're absolutely right about that.
Yes.
And now he's slowly going back and making either prequels or sequels to all of his science fiction hits.
Very sad. It's Blade Runner in particular is a movie that got mixed reviews when it opened. I loved it, named it one of the best films of the year. Nobody cared because I was in high school. But but it's a landmark film, wildly influential visually, certainly.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's a movie that there's absolutely no reason to make a sequel to whatsoever, or a prequel, or a midquel, or anything else.
Well, it was based on a Philip K. Dick short story, wasn't it?
On a novel called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Right. And, Drew McQueenie over at HitFix, he totally believes with you. He says, quote, "I think the notion of any sequel or prequel in that world is a terrible one. Awful. Catastrophically bad. Blade Runner failed by every standard of business measurement. It was beaten senseless by critics at the time." And he goes on to talk about how, even monetarily or fiscally, it didn't do very well.
I don't think it was a disaster. I think it grossed $36 million in the U.S. I don't know what it did overseas, but it was certainly overshadowed by Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and E.T. What was the other one? There was another film, all sci-fi movies that came out at the same time and, of course, did astronomically better at the box office. It was certainly championed by some critics. It's been a long, slow build for this movie to get the, it's now appears on lists of some of the best films of all time. So
that's right. Yeah. Well, and McQueenie goes on to write, and I only quote this because, it's kind of true. The film has had a bit of a cult following. He writes, "The film's long ancillary life was driven by genuine love, by fans who passed it along, by people who refused to have their opinion determined by opening weekend numbers or by toy sales. And now, because of that love, because we kept the film alive long after even its own studio gave up on it, it has become this asset, a valuable widget, and Hollywood wants to make some money with it. And they are counting on those of us who love the original to carry the world. They hired Ridley Scott because they figure that makes them bulletproof."
It means if they're going to make a prequel or sequel, of course you want the original director involved. Why not? It only makes sense. But
right.
But I wouldn't say it was abandoned by this, or that the studio gave up on it, because there have been, I think, 5 different versions that have been released to theaters over the years. There's been a director's cut, an ultimate cut, a final cut.
A director's cut of the ultimate, final, and director's cut.
Midsummer Night's Dream cut. You know, there have been multiple DVD releases, which generally were not, you know, just attempts to cash in, but were generally different, you know, variations and some very, very beautiful, nice packaging and beautiful, interesting cuts. I believe it's the director's cut, which I love. I think it improves the film in every way. And it's amazing some of the things that they cut out. You think, why? They cut out these money shots of these gorgeous vistas of the city, which give the film a sweep and a sensibility that I just love. So I think those variations are really important. And I think none of them were hugely successful at the box office, but they were released, they were shown, they were put out there.
Right.
You know, I think they had a 10th or 20th anniversary release. I mean, this is a movie that, you know, has been shown a little love by its studio. I think they recognized its value over time.
Right. But, well, now, we didn't even explain what Blade Runner was about. It starred Harrison Ford, and Daryl Hannah had a part in it, if I'm not mistaken. Or no, not Daryl Hannah.
No, Daryl Hannah was in it. Yes,
yeah?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm trying to remember the...
Sean Young is who you're thinking of.
Yes, Sean Young is who I'm thinking of. And I probably shouldn't say what character she plays. But needless to say, it's a science fiction movie set in Los Angeles of the future. And I guess it was in the 2000s, 2020, 2025. I can't remember when the film takes place, but it really was fantastic.
Yeah, it was a film noir. You know, Harrison Ford was a hard-bitten cop. And, you know, there's a woman he loves and there's betrayal and cynicism all in a sci-fi setting. It's basically for sort of Philip Marlowe type thing, but set in the future with replicants or robots that he's trying to hunt down and kill because they're basically slaves and have escaped from a space colony and they need to be hunted down and killed because they're not allowed to go free and they're not real people anyway. So what does it matter if you kill them? It's, you know, works on a basic, you know, action level. It's not a terribly action-filled film, but on a basic mystery detective level, it works on a sci-fi level. It's a little philosophical as far as what is life, what is not life, you know, can you kill a robot when they're bleeding and unhappy about it? You know, it's a terrific movie visually, most of all, though. It's an incredibly influential film.
Well, now the biggest news of the week had to have been, and the last 2 weeks since we took a week off, was the resignation of Steve Jobs as the CEO of Apple.
Yes, I don't think it's that big news. I mean, the guy has not been able to make it to the last few conferences, you know, last few press conferences where they're announcing titles and stuff or things that they want to release. You know, if he was well enough to show up for that day, he would be there. And when he's not well enough to do that, clearly he's very ill.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's really, in my opinion, the sad part about this news is that the way he stated that he would be resigning was that he told the board that if he had always promised them that if he was ever unable to fulfill his role as CEO, that he would let them know first. And unfortunately, that day had come, which was kind of a way to telegraph to those of us who kind of could read between the lines, my health is failing.
But, you don't need to read between the lines. When he doesn't show up for the Apple annual event.
Well, the Apple annual event is the Worldwide Developers Conference, and he didn't always show up at that. That was where he launched what did he launch there? He's launched a couple iPhones there, but this year they decided not to launch an iPhone, and there was no big announcement at the Worldwide Developer Conference, maybe because he was sick, I don't know, but because there was no big announcement, nobody showed up.
Well, there was no big announcement because they had to delay the iPhone 5 because of, you know, technical issues because of Japan and the tsunami, I believe.
Well, it's not only that, but of course, here in the U.S., they just released the iPhone 4 on Verizon earlier this year. They wanted to give that some time before they immediately launched the iPhone 5, which at this point is rumored to be coming sometime this fall.
Right, and they also have a delay in the tablet, the next generation of the tablet, because they're having trouble with the new screen that they want to use.
Right.
And producing that. So there's delays everywhere. But obviously, he's a wildly influential guy, but clearly he's been ill for years now. This
yes.
is what I can't act shocked that he's saying, I'm so ill, I can't continue. He's been ill for years. Every time he doesn't show up, there are rumors and questions about his health. So clearly, the man has been ill for years, and he's sadly getting worse.
Yes, and I think that's really, I don't necessarily know that they're shocked, they're just sad. Because, well, and I guess Bob Boylan over at NPR, of course, he's been on the show, and you should really listen to All Songs Considered. It's a great podcast, and his blog is great over at npr.com/music. He wrote a post called How Steve Jobs Changed the Way We Listen, and it's worth a read. And he writes here, in some ways, I feel something like I felt when the Beatles broke up. Sure, I'd always have the band's music, but damn, what a special time. What special chemistry? It will never be the same. And I'd have to agree. I think Apple will be forever changed by Steve Jobs' departure, as we all knew it would be. And I think even though they're saying, oh, he'll remain as the chairman of Apple, I think the way this story was covered, it was almost as if it was an obituary.
Well, it was an honorary title, obviously. If he's not well enough to be involved day to day, you know, he'll contribute as much as he can like he's been doing. And, you know, clearly he's not going to be as involved or he wouldn't change his title. But he did clearly. iTunes is one of the most influential things. The iPod itself, you know, revolutionized the music industry. It made people want MP3s. And when the industry was so slow to adapt, people went elsewhere and started bootlegging and stealing MP3s. And, you know, that's really changed the music industry dramatically. They've never recovered from that shift in consumer preference.
It's really difficult to revolutionize anything, any industry. Here's a guy who did it four times. He did it with personal computing. He then did it with music. And he did it with the post-PC era with...
The tablet?
The tablet. And, you know, I skipped over one. The phone.
Yes.
The mobile phone. I mean, to do that four times, you can see why people are sad. I mean, I think Bob Boylan is right. I mean, we listen to music today totally different than we did in the 20th century. And a large part of that is because of iTunes and the iPod and the things that Steve Jobs' company created.
That's true. The iPod built on the Walkman, of course, but it absolutely did change and brought back the single and did so much for the industry. In computers, he realized computers didn't have to be ugly. There's no reason they had to all be beige and grotesque looking. He brought design and style to the home computer world. That was massively important. The tablet is clearly, it's a whole new market, just like, not even like the iPod or the iPhone. It's literally a whole new market, a new type of device to consume media. And we still haven't seen the full impact of what that might do. And of course, the iPhone. You know, other people had smartphones. They just did it so much better that everybody wants the iPhone.
Think about it. I mean, I think it was 1997, he came back to Apple. He started it with Steve Wozniak and others, was escorted out of the building by the board in the 80s, and then was brought back in 1997. The company was floundering, and he had to borrow or get $100 million from Bill Gates, his friend, over at Microsoft, and Microsoft wanted to pay that money because they needed a competitor out there because they were undergoing some antitrust issues at the time. And so from 1997 to 2007 and now, of course, 2011, they've become the biggest company on the planet, or one of them.
And in his spare time, he helped launch Pixar.
Yeah, just, you know, for fun. He just decided to launch, you know, one of the most successful animation and film companies ever created. It was, of course, purchased in 2006 by Disney for $7.4 billion.
But I'm sure as long as Apple adapts to Scrum, that they'll be able to keep innovating along for many years to come.
Actually, they do work with Scrum, but that's a
I'm sure they do.
Yeah, that's a very technical term you're using there. And if you don't know what Scrum is, I'm sure if you Google that, you'll figure out that it's a project management software tool. But in any case, Bob Boylan was talking about how Steve Jobs affected the music industry and the way we listen. And Joe Flint over at the LA Times was talking about, hey, wait a second, you know, Steve Jobs revolutionized TV too. Because back in 2005, TV, yeah, I mean, not
isn't
because
that the one area that Apple failed at?
Well, I don't think he's referring to necessarily Apple televisions, because they don't make a television, despite the fact that there are many rumors that they might release one, if not this year, then sometime next year or in the future.
He's certainly not talking about the Cube, the Apple TV thing.
No. What he's referring to really is the fact that Steve Jobs went to Disney, where he is now on the board. I believe he's still on the board. And he got Disney to release ABC and certain programming the day after the episode aired on television. It would be on iTunes for purchase. Nobody had done that before, and everybody thought, oh my goodness, this is the end of television, and this is really going to be a huge disruptor. But what Joe Flynn points out is that both Disney and Jobs knew that, look, this is going to happen whether you want it or not. It'll happen because of piracy, or it'll happen in some other way, but you need to start adapting. And Disney and Jobs kind of had the foresight to start figuring out a way to monetize these properties in other formats other than being broadcast over television.
Well, that's a point I hadn't considered. I mean, Hulu started 2 years later in 2007, I believe.
That's right.
I would say that he saw that something needed to happen there, just like the Apple TV, but he didn't actually make it work, whether because people were resistant to making deals or whatever the case may be. But he certainly had the right idea in that area too. I don't think he was that influential because he didn't make, he wasn't successful at it. But certainly he saw what was going on there as well and was prescient about that.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. I mean, he didn't do everything at Apple. He had lots of great people around him. But at the end of the day, he created the culture and created a culture of innovation. And I realize that, I mean, you watch any of the documentaries that feature Steve Jobs and people will tell you how much of a not nice guy he really is and how, I mean, this is a guy there's an infamous story about how he was attending a meeting on Monday morning and he walks into a conference room and somebody says, "Oh, hey, Steve, how was your weekend?" And he silently, you know, after a pregnant pause, said, "Can we raise the level of conversation in this room?" He could be a bit of a personality to deal with, but also a genius.
That's perhaps why we're not successful. We're too damn nice.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to start treating people like crap starting today.
Well, let's raise the level of discourse here and move on to, wait a second, the MTV Video Music Awards?
Yeah, that's not
that
really...
That may be lowering it.
That, well, of course, if you watched... Did you watch these things? Probably not because you were mopping up. I mean, they're not really a lot of fun to watch. They're kind of boring, except there's always one or two things that happen during each broadcast of these things, which are kind of a joke. I mean, let's face it, nobody really votes on these in any real way, and they're given to... It's like a popularity contest. Lady Gaga came out. This year's big thing, in my opinion, was Lady Gaga coming out, and she came out dressed as Joe Calderone, her male alter ego, and she looked like she came right out of the 50s, was talking with the Brooklyn accent, and she came out smoking and did this whole spoken word piece filled with profanity, winds up, you know, chugging a beer at one point, although she didn't really drink much of it. And then she goes into her routine. And, you know, the little spoken word piece was kind of funny because it was all about Lady Gaga and she was talking about Lady Gaga as if it wasn't her. But she did mention that Lady Gaga is just theater. Needless to say, it left everybody kind of scratching their heads. Britney Spears, there was a shot of her at one point, mouth agape. And I'm thinking, wait, you're shocked at this? Then, you know, all hell has broken loose here. She did bring out, which got a kind of a nice round of applause, Brian May, Queen's guitarist, and she played, I guess, a song called You and I, and they played together. And then, you know, another shot of Adele looking just completely puzzled, Justin Bieber, like, just sitting there silently. It was very interesting. I think you can probably look it up on the MTV website. But it was really Katy Perry who held the night. She won the Video of the Year for Firework.
And, of course, she made box office history at the same time. Chart history, I should
say. Billboard history, I would say.
Yes, her song Last Friday Night, TGIF, hit number one. I didn't think it was going to because the song by LMFAO was keeping her out of the number one slot for quite a few weeks. But she finally kicked them out of the top spot, went to number one. And so that means she has 5 number one singles from one album. She's the first woman to ever do that. And only Michael Jackson, I think, has done that as far as a single artist. Maybe Saturday Night Fever. Maybe there's a soundtrack that has 5 number one singles. I don't know, but they might be the only 2 people in history to have done it. Michael Jackson did it with Bad, and Katy Perry did it with Teenage Dream, California Girls, Firework, E.T., and now Friday.
Yeah, no, I think she stands up there alone with Michael Jackson. And remember, this is 5 number one hit singles on the Billboard Hot 100.
From the
same album. That's the key. It's kind of interesting, you know, I don't know necessarily who writes her music. I don't know if she's the one who writes it, but it's a huge achievement. And speaking of people who write music, kind of a little bit of a sad note is that, well, 2 people passed away. The first we'll talk about is Jerry Lieber, a prolific writer from the 1950s who died.
Lieber and Stoller, obviously.
Lieber and Stoller, that's right. And as a matter of fact, I knew somewhat about Lieber and Stoller, but when he passed away and I read all of these obituaries, I went out and purchased Hound Dog, which is their autobiography that they wrote, and I think it was published in 2009. It's told in a very interesting way. They each tell stories back and forth. Of course, Lieber was the lyricist, Stoller wrote the music, and together they wrote rock and roll songs like Hound Dog, which, who is the guy that made that famous again? He was a little guy. Yeah,
Elvis
Presley. Yes, that's right. Yakety Yak, Stand By Me on Broadway. You know, he died at 78.
Yes, well, and Ashford of Ashford and Simpson also passed away.
Yes. Now, they were both great songwriters. I mean, do you hold the Lieber and Stoller group or team in any affinity, or you could care less?
Oh, no, no, no. They're a major early rock and roll, Yakety Yak, Hound Dog. They wrote a ton of rock and roll songs. They even had a Broadway musical built around their music. I mean, they're a significant act, especially from the 50s and early 60s.
Yeah, the Drifters and Benny King and, of course, Elvis Presley. The Brill Building, they were a huge influence over the Brill Building, which I think, what's his name? Why am I? Neil Diamond had a whole album full of songs called The Brill Building.
Neil Diamond wrote at the Brill Building along with Carole King and, you know, tons of people. Yeah, you know, that's the early days for a lot of the songwriters that were big in New York at the time. And looking up Katy Perry's credits, she does have a co-songwriting credit on all those singles.
You
know, it's usually a team of people. You know, sometimes it's contractual, but for all I know, she's the lead songwriter. I have no idea. But there's certainly three or four or five people on almost all those songs, and she's, you know, right at the top.
You know, what's amazing to me is that Lieber and Stoller met in 1950 while Lieber was still a student at Fairfax High School in Los Angeles. I mean, that's pretty amazing that from 1950, a student in high school, to 1956, Hound Dog being, you know, a number one hit with Elvis Presley. That's pretty amazing.
That is. And I looked up Saturday Night Fever. That only had four number one singles from the soundtrack. So I guess Michael Jackson and Katy Perry do, in fact, stand alone.
Yes. Well, I guess maybe we should move on to some television news. And really the only thing we want to cover, and I debated whether we kind of went back and forth, do we cover this or not? There was a suicide a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. Russell Armstrong, who was one of the husbands on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, which in and of itself means, you know, Real Housewives aren't on TV. So how can it be The Real Housewives? But anyway, he committed suicide.
Yeah, well, very sad news. Of course, it meant they're re-editing the show, and they've even delayed, I believe, the season opener.
By 1 week, from what I understand.
Yeah, just to try and show a little empathy and sensitivity to the situation. Somebody had talked about maybe they were thinking of scrapping the season altogether, especially because he's apparently played a fairly significant role in some of the storylines, but that hasn't taken place. They're moving ahead. Very sad news. Of course, these are real people.
That's right. And, well, you know, part of the story here was, what do these reality shows do to people? Because Russell Armstrong was quite critical of Bravo in the way that they kind of created his character. And he said it wasn't him, that it was a completely fictitious person. He then became estranged to his wife, Taylor Armstrong, who was the housewife in question here. And I don't know. I mean, there was an interesting article in The Hollywood Reporter about it. I'm sure people will continue to debate it. There was, as you mentioned, some talk about canceling the entire season, but Bravo probably said, no, we still need some programming. So, but I'll be honest, I didn't even know they had a Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Well, they've got one in tons of cities, DC, Atlanta, New York, you know, they go all over the place.
Yeah, I guess that's why I mean, at this point, I don't even pay attention to them.
Well, I never watched any of them, but there you go.
Well, is she still a housewife then? Technically, she's a house widow? No? House? I don't know.
You can be a housewife and still a single mom, a housewife.
That's true.
I think it's more of a honorary title.
Okay. Well,
they have businesses, they have careers, they have things that they do. They're not just stay-at-home moms doing the laundry.
Okay. Well, I guess maybe I should watch the show once or twice. That would probably help before trying to talk about it.
Yeah, it does raise the issue, though. You know, you've got TV shows with young people and families and parents, and people are going to get sick. They're going to come out, as in, you know, the Loud family in an American Family in the early 70s. That was a titanic moment in television where a cast member came out, you know, to their family on television while the show was being made. You've got people who hurt themselves or die or, you know, get ill and sick. You know, Pedro Zamora on MTV's The Real World got sick and died. You know, he didn't die during the season, but he had come onto the show having AIDS. And then they found out, of course, that he was, you know, getting sicker and sicker. These things happen to the characters that are on these shows. And, you know, that's why it's called reality television.
Yeah, I mean, and certainly The Real World helped bring reality television into being, in my opinion. And that
into the modern era. There's been reality TV since the day television began.
Well, okay, fair enough. And I guess that was in 1994. In my opinion, that whole Pedro Zamora episode or kind of
season.
Yeah, I mean, that really helped bring AIDS to the fore. I mean, it brought it front and center.
No. AIDS had been widely visible at that point. It just was brought it home to a new generation of kids. But 94 was well past the period when people were talking about AIDS. It was not a, it it wasn't introducing the idea of AIDS to people.
No, put a face on it for kids. That's kind of what I mean. So thank you for straightening up what I meant to say. But you know, I haven't watched the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and may never watch it, but there is definitely a Broadway show that I won't see because it's about to close. And Michael, you were right. The Addams Family will not make it without Nathan Lane. And I cannot remember the name of the person who was Morticia Addams.
For shame.
I never saw it. So how could I remember?
Because she's a Broadway legend.
And
starred in Chicago.
Okay. Is this like a guessing game now? Because I'm going to fail.
B.B. Newirth.
Ah, okay. Yes, that's right. How could I forget that?
She's a very big draw herself, though Nathan Lane may be the biggest draw on Broadway right now, but she certainly is a huge draw herself. So together, they were a huge part of that show's success while it was on Broadway. Since they've been gone, it's dropped to about half of its gross. And, you know, it's probably profitable week to week, but it's probably not worth it to keep it going.
Well, I mean, last year, for the week ending August 21st, the show grossed about $1.1 million and played to an 86% capacity audience. And for the same week this year, so 2011 instead of 2010, it grossed about $700,000 and played to about a 77% capacity audience.
Yeah, so I should say it dropped by about, was that 30%?
30%, yeah, 30-ish percent, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah, that's what happens. It had a nice healthy run. You know, most shows do not run 2 years. So, you know, it's had a good run. And now it's going off into the sunset to tour.
Do you think that it made money? I mean, it cost $16.5 million to produce this musical. Do you think at the end of the day, its Broadway run was profitable or break even, or it didn't really matter because all that mattered was the national tour?
It does matter how it does on Broadway because that's the most expensive part of a show. I'm not sure. I don't think they announced. Normally, they would announce when a show makes its money back. That's a big deal for Broadway. They like to say, hey, we made our money. We didn't lose our money. So imagine if a Hollywood studio said, hey, our movie broke even. You know, that's sort of a big day on Broadway because so many shows don't.
Right.
I don't believe that they announced they had broken even. That doesn't mean they won't once you add in the road and overseas and all that.
Right.
It's such a strong brand name. It might do okay. It's still probably a question mark, you know, because – you had such two big stars in it, and they were clearly a draw. But the name does mean something to people. Brooke Shields is in it right now. She's in it through the end of the year when the show closes.
I know that seemed like a
It's touring in the U.S. and Brazil and then Sydney. It'll probably open in London at some point. And I don't believe that it has announced break-even yet. So it'll probably close on Broadway, not having made back its money. But it's probably gone a fair way towards that.
Well, and certainly one show that has not made back its money, and some question whether it ever will, is Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. It did not have a $16.5 million budget. It had a $65 million budget, and some say that number is even higher. Now, the star of that show is Reeve Carney, and he is going to be playing Jeff Buckley in a biographical film. Now, this wouldn't be a big deal, except for two reasons.
It'd be a big deal to him.
Well, yeah, it's a big deal to him. But now, Jeff Buckley is the kind of rock and roll singer who died in 1997 after drowning at the age of 30. It's the second film about Jeff Buckley announced within 2 weeks. So that's the first big deal. The second is, wait, is he going to leave the Broadway show now after kind of seeing it through for over a year? When is he going to leave?
Well, he's been in the show already for like a year and a half now.
Right.
He's been in rehearsals and things and on the show. The show's been open for almost a year November or October.
Right. And not open necessarily, but in preview. So it's been, certainly performances have been going on.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it opened on Broadway in previews, you know, in, I believe, October.
Yes.
Did they delay it to November? I'm not sure. I'm still looking. No, performances began in November of 2010. He's probably booked through, you know, November of 2011. A year on Broadway. That's a long, long time to do a musical 8 days a week.
Will it be the same without Reeve Carney? Because he is...
Oh, absolutely. He's not a draw at all.
Okay. Well, I mean, he is supposed to be this great rock musician and star.
He's not a star. He didn't get great reviews. The show got terrible reviews. Nobody singled him out as being, you know, despite this horrible legend show, Reeve Carney does a good job. No, he's sort of a cog in the machine. God bless him. That's why it's so great for him that he's gotten an actual juicy movie role out of this. His band, Carney, may have to wait around a while before they get to do an album and tour. But no, this is great news for him because he certainly was not singled out. Nobody said he was a problem. Nobody said he was the reason the show wasn't good. It was the songs and the
everything else.
The script and the book and the look and everything. Yeah, he was not the problem, but by no means was he singled out as being terrific or really good or anything like that.
So not a big deal then?
No, not a big deal at all. Not a big deal that he would leave. A big deal for him that he would get the role and get a chance to do something good, perhaps, and establish himself as an actor with this role playing Jeff Buckley.
Well, maybe we do have some other stories where you'll find that, you know, they might be a big deal. In Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and decide whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story brings us right back to Apple. Apple is ending its TV episode rental service, which began nearly a year ago, and Apple had to persuade the television networks to try out a television episode rental service through the iTunes store, and now they've quietly taken this service down. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I say it's a big whoop because, as we said before, Apple never really solved the puzzle of television. They want to create a TV. They want the Apple TV box to stream stuff from your computer to the TV. They want to be renting you TV shows. None of it worked out for them the way it did with music.
Yeah, I mean, they basically said iTunes customers have shown they overwhelmingly prefer to buy TV shows, and thus they're not.
That's not true. iTunes customers have shown that they overwhelmingly prefer to watch them for free on Hulu and other services.
But those might not be iTunes customers.
Yes, they most certainly are.
Our next story, RIM unveils new cloud-based service, cloud-based music service, it should say. Canada's Research in Motion, the maker of BlackBerry phones, has unveiled a new cloud-based social music sharing service called BBM Music. They're going to select music from Universal Music Group, Sony Entertainment, Warner Music, and EMI, which would be available for users at around $5 a month. I do not understand why they're getting into this, but Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. They're just way behind the times. BlackBerry's always been a business-type phone with, you know, great text and email. But they finally realized they needed to provide some music. People were just going more and more to the iPhone and other smartphones. They felt like it was a gap in what the service that they provided. I don't think they're doing a very good job with it. They're really late to the game. I don't understand why it's cloud-based, but there you go.
Yeah, streaming music is, you know, if you don't have a streaming music offering these days, then you're nobody.
That's right.
Now, speaking of that, speaking of streaming music, Pandora had to release some quarterly numbers, and it showed that they've continued to lose money. They are struggling towards profitability, according to the financial details they just disclosed. They counted about $1.8 million in losses for the last 3 months ending July 31st. But that's a reversal, actually, from a year ago of roughly the same amount. So as well, now here's some big numbers for you. They have 1.8 billion listening hours during the three-month period and a 125% increase year over year, and an impressive 3.6% of all radio listening hours, according to their calculations. And here's the thing. They actually earned more money. Revenues
But the revenues went up, but the cost of getting the music went up much more.
That's where I was headed. So really, I guess, is it a big deal or a big whoop that they made $67 million on loss and that losses topped $8.6 million over the past
God,
6 months?
God, you're confusing me. Confusing me.
But is it a big deal that basically they're
losing money?
Well, their licensing keeps going up. It's not stable.
They're losing money. Their quarterly losses continue to grow. They keep losing money. They're still not turning a profit. That's the gist of it.
That's right. And of course, Pandora is the streaming music service.
And that is a big deal. In the old tech boom, in the last tech boom, that would have meant it's time to go do an initial public offering and raise hundreds of millions of dollars. But
they've already done that.
Exactly. They've already done it, unfortunately. At some point you got to start making money. It's not a good sign. They got a lot of people listening to them, obviously. 1.8 billion listening hours during 3 months. That's pretty darn 600 million hours a month. That's, 20 million hours a week, a day.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So that's pretty good, but they're not making money off of it. And they can't lock down the costs. And the cost of licensing that music continue to grow, and they're never going to make money at that rate.
Yeah, I mean, really, you look at radio, and there's this kind of like overall license that you have to pay when you play a song. And I think at some point they're going to have to do the same thing with online music. Instead of negotiating each streaming service independently and individually, they're going to have to say, look, if you stream this particular song online, it will cost you 7 cents.
Well, but the radio record labels have no incentive to do that. They want to make more money. They felt like they were giving away their music too much for free to radio. Now they're like, hey, we can charge you for it. Great. Why would they want to go back to giving it away mostly for free? You have to have a blanket license to to play songs on the radio and you pay money out to publishers and songwriters and musicians, but you don't pay the record label to play the song on your radio if you're over the air terrestrial radio. If you're online, you do. And why would the radio records companies ever want to give that up?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how radio got away with it and how that was formed with radio. I'll look that up.
Well, because it was free promotion. Hey, play the song on the radio, then people go buy the 45. That was the whole idea.
And that's where the record label made their money.
Right. It's like the cable companies. You know, the cable companies are forced to carry the major networks. The major networks wish they were cable channels so that they could charge cable companies and get money for airing their most popular shows. You know, NBC says, hey, why don't we get paid money? You know, just like you pay HBO and ESPN. We'd like that $2 a month per subscriber.
Carriage fees, yes.
Yeah, it's just not going to happen if they can avoid it.
Well, Lady Gaga, Katy Perry, and the Backstreet Boys have been recognized in China as threats to the domestic culture. The China's Ministry of Culture added songs by the artists to an updated list of 100 songs that cannot be legally downloaded because they endanger national cultural security. And officially what this means is that the songs weren't run through the Ministry of Culture. That's really what it means. Not that their content is subversive or, you know.
But most of them wouldn't be approved even if they were.
Exactly. Submitted. Exactly. I mean, they would never be approved.
Why are there only 100 songs? Do they just keep updating all the time for the most popular new hits?
I guess so. Is it a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop because they're all illegal anyway, probably. And it's not fun to be a music fan in China.
That's true. The toxicology report for Amy Winehouse has reportedly come back with no illegal substances, and that's according to the family of Amy Winehouse. They're saying that there were no drugs in her body at the time of her death. They did say that there was some alcohol present, but they couldn't determine as yet if it played a role in her death. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. We need to wait for a final report. The latest rumor or idea is that she was trying to go cold turkey on her own, and which is what caused her to die from, you know, massive withdrawal of alcohol after years of, you know, alcohol abuse. But you know, we're not going to know until we get a final official report, and the family is not the best source for that information.
Yeah, I don't know why the family is involved in...
Well, they wanted to sort of say, hey, you know what? You all think she was doing heroin and she wasn't. We're like, well, you know, she was a messed up, sad lady. We're glad if she wasn't, and we don't know what caused her to die. But, you know, it's just a sad waste no matter what it is. But clearly she had years of abuse.
YouTube has inked some licensing deals with music publishers, speaking of licensing. They are ending a 4-year legal battle with over 3,000 independent music publishers. So that they can play some of the songs that people upload to, I guess, in video form to YouTube.
Well, yeah, this is YouTube's had an arrangement for a long time now with EMI, Universal, and Warner and Sony. And you'll see, like, people, they use actual songs in their YouTube clips, you know, in their home videos, and up will pop an ad saying, hey, buy this song right away. You know, it's a really smart way of saying, okay, people are going to use pop songs in their videos that they upload to YouTube. Let's take advantage of that and try and make some sales rather than trying to clamp them down and foolishly try and stop all use of any music anywhere ever. And it's been working great, but there have been a whole bunch of independent music publishers that YouTube hadn't done a deal with, and they finally able to come over and make a deal with the NMPA and do a blanket license to cover all of them as well. So that makes a lot more music available without any restrictions on YouTube.
The National Music Publishers Association is who you're referring to there.
Yeah, that's an umbrella group for thousands of independent music publishers that aren't covered by, you know, EMI and Universal and Warner and so on. So I think it's a big deal.
Yeah, of course, you know, the four major publishers, EMI, as you mentioned, Universal, Warner, and Sony, not covered. So,
well, they have their deals already.
Oh, okay.
They're covered. They have their own deals with YouTube. They've had them in place for ages. But there's been this straggle of thousands of small little indie publishers who hadn't come to terms yet with YouTube, and they were all finally able to come to an agreement. So I think it's a big deal and a good step.
Right. You know, I was actually at a children's birthday party, and there was some music playing. And I realized after looking for the source of the music that it was actually coming out of a computer. This store had set up a YouTube playlist of pop songs, and it just was cycling through this playlist. And, you know, nobody was watching them, but they were using the video's audio as their DJ, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. My sister at Christmas time hands me her tablet and says, hey, put Christmas songs on Rhapsody. Create a playlist. And so there you go. There's your Christmas music coming out of your tablet. So there's all sorts of crazy ways people access music now.
Ricky Gervais, the comedian who hosted the Golden Globes so controversially, he's hosted them twice now, and he may do it for a third time. Gervais at the Media Guardian Edinburgh International Television Festival. Now, that's a mouthful. They should probably rename that or come up with some acronym. But anyway, he said that NBC, which broadcast the awards, had asked him to return, and this is according to The Guardian, it would be his third time hosting, but he hinted it's probably not likely that he would come back. He says, you know, what am I going back for? You know, I've already done everything. I'm glad NBC stuck by me during this whole, you know, controversy, but I'm not going back. Big deal or big whoop?
Man offered job. I would say big whoop. That's a little nod to our old friend Karen Woodward. You know, the show got great ratings. He got tons of attention. I believe we said at the time on the show, why wouldn't they want him back? Of course they'll invite him back. And apparently they have, according to Ricky Gervais. It would be crazy of the Golden Globes and NBC not to invite him back. I don't think it would be NBC, though, but I think it would be the Globe people themselves. But I don't know.
I think they
charge.
Have to agree, yeah. You know,
right.
I think, yeah.
But of course they're going to invite him back. He got tons of attention and, you know, everybody was fine.
You know, he also said that he'd been approached to host the Oscars, and he said, no way am I doing that. It's a thankless task for a comedian, he said. They don't want to hear jokes. They want to hear if they won the most important award of their career, which I thought was kind of funny. He's right.
That I find interesting. I don't know if he means this year. I think he probably means prior years.
Yes, I would agree with you on that, because ABC said, we never offered that to him. And I think what they mean is, we never offered that to him for next year.
At the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Abercrombie and Fitch, the clothing manufacturer, they have offered to pay the quote-unquote Situation, who is a character on Jersey Shore, and I mean character, let me tell you. They've offered to pay him to stop wearing their clothes because they feel that, I guess, he doesn't really set a good example. They will give him a substantial payment in what they call a win-win deal for both people. Big deal or big whoop.
Oh, that's kind of funny. I saw MTV take it as sort of cheeky and tongue-in-cheek and not a very serious offer. They felt like it was just a publicity stunt by Abercrombie and Fitch.
It's a great publicity stunt, if it is.
Yeah. I think that's probably what it is, too. They wouldn't make it public if they were trying to do it. I can agree that they think, you know, it's not great to have them wearing their stuff, and they want to make sure that they don't get tagged as just Jersey Shore type apparel. It reminds me of the old, urban tale that, like, a top designer would be walking through an airport and see some, you know, incredibly obese, typical American from the heartland wearing a t-shirt with his logo on it. He would pay them money to give them the t-shirt and say, oh, I collect t-shirts, you know, and then he orders that they never make t-shirts that large ever again. You know, you don't want to make them that big. So, you know, people are very aware of who uses their stuff and whether it makes them trendy and cool for a moment that can burn them out. Or whether it's, you know, useful. It's a very tricky, you know, thing to do. You don't want to not take advantage of the trendy popularity, but you don't want to spike so much in sales and popularity that people turn on you. You know, you want to become an evergreen. And I think Abercrombie & Fitch is more comfortable with naked young people in their catalogs rather than Jersey Shore people.
Yeah, right. And if they really had any issue with this, they could blur out the Abercrombie & Fitch logo in all of the footage. So,
but they could say, we don't give the right for you to wear that.
Right, exactly. Now, did you see Larry Crown, the movie that was directed and starred, well, it starred Julie Roberts and Tom Hanks, but it was directed by Tom Hanks. Did you see that movie?
No, I didn't.
Well, then I guess you should not get in touch with Tom Hanks and ask for your money back. But if you did, he just might give it to you, because the National Enquirer is reporting that Hanks was filling up his car at a petrol station. So you can tell this was written by somebody from the UK. He was filling up his car with gas, petrol, whatever you want to call it, here in Los Angeles, when he was approached by a couple who had just seen the film, Larry Crown, and Hanks asked, hey, did you enjoy it? And the man replied that it wasn't very good. And his partner politely explained that they had come to expect a little bit more from their favorite actor. So Hanks then reportedly apologized and offered to refund their ticket money and eventually gave them $25 out of his own pocket. I think that's a bad example to start. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm going to say... Yeah, I'm going to say this is a big whoop because it was in the National Enquirer and it's almost certainly a lie. It sounds like just the typical urban myth story. It appeared in the UK newspaper The Guardian, which is quoting the National Enquirer, which you certainly shouldn't do, especially when they're not reporting on politicians' peccadillos and quoting people by name. It's a secondhand tale repeated and, you know, put in the National Enquirer without any direct quotes from anybody. So, you know, it's all malarkey. So it should not be reported at all. And it's a big whoop and we shouldn't have covered it.
I apologize.
No, that's okay. It's just like it's the National Enquirer. In sports, Alex Rodriguez is being called to the commissioner's office to answer reports about him being involved in online very high-stakes poker games. I am no fan of Alex Rodriguez. I love the Yankees and I want him to do well, but I do not like Alex Rodriguez. But this is a report in Star Magazine. You know, why is the baseball commissioner paying attention to something in Star Magazine? You know, Alex Rodriguez puts up with enough grief for all this dumb stuff he does, and he's, you know, brought shame on baseball. But he should not have to respond to something in Star Magazine. I'm sorry, that's ridiculous. And sort of in the same vein where I say this is a big whoop.
Okay, well then how about where we do name some people? Like,
that's what I want to hear.
A story where we're actually going to name somebody, and the name is Lindsey Buckingham of Fleetwood Mac.
I love Lindsey Buckingham.
Yeah, you know, one part of Fleetwood Mac, I guess several band members, but he says the band is getting back together again, and they're thinking about maybe recording a new album in the near future, possibly going out on tour. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. I mean, why wouldn't they go back on tour? I assume it doesn't include Christine McVie. She seems to have retired. I don't know why. Even if she doesn't want to go on tour, I'm not sure why she wouldn't record with them again, but she doesn't seem to even want to do that. It would be great news, one, if there was an actual, they were in the studio recording, or two, they'd announced a tour date. This is just like, yeah, maybe it's going to happen.
Yeah, ran into Lindsey Buckingham on the street.
I have to say it's a big whoop. If Christine McVie goes into the studio with them, that'll be an even bigger whoop. And when they actually announce the tour dates, that'll be a big whoop again. Their heyday is way past, but you know, they're a great group.
Hold on, just making a note. No stories from the National Enquirer and nothing about Fleetwood Mac on future shows. Okay.
Until they have firm news.
Okay. Well, that moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. Now, I don't necessarily know that this week's story will actually affect you too much, although maybe if you see Kesha, which, what a name, Kesha? I mean, come on, really? Anyway, it turns out she earns 5 times as much as Loretta Lynn. And why do we know that? Because there are things in the music industry called riders. So in the concert industry, you have to have a contract to play a specific venue or event, and that's called a rider. And it states what the guarantee is for the artist and what the artist needs to perform. And there's a whole bunch of legal mumbo jumbo. But every once in a while, one of these riders, or in this case, several of these riders, get leaked to some news organization, and they then find out how much, you know, the Rolling Stones or U2 or whoever it is are paid to play a single event. And in this case, Kesha, the pop star, how much do you think she's paid?
You mean what's her guarantee for a concert?
That's right. Now, it's a guarantee, which means she will definitely make this amount of money and may make more if, you know, tickets sell and it's a sold-out show.
What kind of size venue is she playing? She's got to be playing. I'm not sure if she's touring with them. She's on the Get Sleazy tour, as I recall. I think that's what her tour is called. And I'm not sure what size venue she's playing.
Well, she's playing, like, I guess, the Paramount Theater in New York. She's not playing Madison Square Garden.
She's playing like 5,000 seats. Well, I wouldn't imagine it'd be that much then. 50,000, 75,000?
I mean, $200,000 is her guarantee, which might explain why Groupon is trying to, like, offload tickets to her show here in L.A. But she makes $200,000 a show guaranteed. Melissa Etheridge makes $125,000 a show guaranteed. Now, there's somebody who's worth it. Blake Shelton, I know you like Blake Shelton, $100,000 per
show. He's got a top 15 album right now. And in fact, looking at the album charts, 4 or 5 of the albums in the top 15 are country albums, which I think is kind of notable. I think it's because we're in a recession and country music tends to do well then.
Yeah, well.
So, and country acts tend to be very, very dependable on the road. I'm sure there are other people on this list who are from country music. Who else is on this list?
Trace Adkins. $100,000.
This is just a random list. This is not a list.
This is the list that the smokinggun.com got. So,
right, it's not a list of the top people guarantees or the current whatever. It just happens to be people they got info on.
That's right. I mean, Tone Loc is on this list. He makes $5,000.
Tone Loc is still touring?
Yeah, exactly. There you go. And get this. Loretta Lynn, by the way, $40,000 per show. But, you know, Whitesnake makes $85,000. Whitesnake? What? And Meatloaf, $100,000. I mean, this is...
Meatloaf is a very dependable concert draw, though.
Yeah, okay, true. But here's, you know, one of the funny things about riders is they have all of these little clauses in them that talk about, like, what the artist needs in their dressing room very often.
Sure.
And Meatloaf, who actually collapsed on stage recently, he needs 2 tanks of oxygen, along with 2 oxygen masks and then 2 paramedics there to administer the oxygen. So,
he has it in his rider that paramedics have to be present?
Yes.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, in capital letters, this is a must.
Oh, God.
Now, Kesha needs 1 rigger to hang a pinata. And yes, each time the singer's name appears in the contract documents, the S appears as a dollar sign, as it does on her albums.
That's her legal name, baby. Yeah. Gotta learn to spell it.
Tone Loc, we were just talking about him, along with 24 chicken wings, Hooters preferred, with blue cheese. His dressing room is stocked with a large bottle of Hennessy and Hypnotic, a pale blue concoction of premium French vodka. I mean, these things are always kind of funny when you start to read them.
Well, it's, you know, he knows how to live.
Yeah, well, I guess.
So what, how do these impact fans? The contract guarantees matter because the more amount of money they're guaranteed, the higher ticket prices are.
Yes, that's right.
Because the venue has to make sure they're going to get their money back.
Well, promoters need to make sure they get their money back because the venue, you know, charges the flat fee and the promoter, which are now one and the same.
It depends, doesn't it?
Usually it's the promoter that puts the bill, but these days the promoter and the venue is the same person.
Yeah, exactly. So that matters. So you can see none of these people are, well, I guess Keisha is pretty profitable, but she's a big act right now, but that's a fairly high guarantee. So her tickets would probably be expensive, but the higher the guarantee, the more money they're going to have to charge you tickets. And that's why someone like Garth Brooks would go out and have a very low guarantee, because he wanted to keep ticket prices at $20, $25, $30. Because he wanted to fill seats and have fans there. And, that's what happens. The artists have a lot of control over the ticket prices. If they don't want high tickets, then they don't ask for a big guarantee. And guess what? They can make sure we'll ask for, you know, a $50,000 guarantee. And that means you have to, you know, not charge more than X amount of dollars for tickets.
Right. And, you know, actually, I was talking recently to a lawyer who works with Live Nation, actually works for Live Nation. And they were telling me that the problem with Live Nation's profitability has been these astronomical guarantees. So, you know, whether it's Beyonce or Rihanna.
Well, it's not that it's a problem. It's that they shouldn't agree to them if they don't think they can be profitable.
Right.
You know,
precisely.
They can't blame it on the artist. If the artist can get 300,000, well, then they, you know, I'm speaking out of the other way now. I was saying if the artist wants to lower ticket prices, they need to not ask for a big guarantee. But if they want the money, they get the money. If it's too much for the venue, they've got to know when to walk away and say, oh, no, wait, that's too much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we're agreeing on this. You know, the market will ultimately correct this. Now, there is one thing that I should point out about riders, and they can actually be used for some very smart things. David Lee Roth, and this is a very well-known story that he has confirmed, in the rider, he would say, we need a bowl of M&Ms when he played with Van Halen. We need a bowl of M&Ms, and there can't be any green M&Ms in the bowl. And he did that on purpose. I mean, most people thought, wow, what a jerk, you know, making me pick all these green M&Ms out of a bag of M&Ms. However, the first thing he checked when he got to a venue was whether there were green M&Ms in that bowl of candy, because he felt that if there were, then the people at that venue were not detail-oriented, and he would have to check everything from the contract and all of the sound and tech they'd have to go through.
Well, in the stage, we've seen stages collapse all around the world in the last 2 weeks. There have been two or three stage collapses where people have died. I think, was it Lady Antebellum at one outdoor venue?
Yes, in
Indiana.
And
other artists overseas. Yeah, that's kind of interesting. That's a sort of a bellwether sign of whether your venue is being run properly from people who are, you know, looking at every detail. That's kind of an interesting thing.
And that was in the rider. So that's a little bit about riders, and that kind of ends Inside Baseball for this week. But we do have some listener voicemail and some listener email.
All right. Well, that's what happens when we take 2 weeks off.
Yes, that's true. Now, our first voicemail comes from Krista in Las Vegas.
Hey, showbiz. This is Krista from Las Vegas. I'm about to leave a comment about the Kim Kardashian and her wedding and about all the kind of money she made off of it and all the gifts that she's given, and how some people are debatable on whether it should have went to charity. I feel as if Kim was a sweet girl and had a kind heart, that she would take those gifts and maybe give them to other women who weren't as fortunate when they had their weddings, or even give the money to maybe four brides or however many it takes to make sure they have that special wedding and help them pick out their dress and everything that they could have that could be just as magical as her wedding was. Because other girls feel the same way, and they want that day to be just as special as Kim's day was for her. Well, thank you, Showbiz, and I love watching your show, and thanks. Bye.
I don't know how she's watching us, though. I mean...
Well, she means listening.
Well, yeah, she means listening, but I, just in case, I actually didn't do the show in my underwear today.
Good idea. I think she's confusing Kim Kardashian with a real person. but yeah. You know,
and you mean that kind of in a joking way that, you know, that Kim Kardashian, like
Kim Kardashian's out there to make money, baby.
Yeah, that's right. And what she's referring to actually is that initially her husband Chris Humphries and Kim Kardashian, who's kind of a reality show star.
Not kind of, she is.
She is, yeah. She raked in $300,000 for their engagement announcement back in May and $100,000 from OK to take photos at the bridal shower. But then The Hollywood Reporter says that People Magazine paid $1.5 million for the exclusive wedding day photo. So she's made, you know, close to $2 million on this wedding. And maybe Chris is getting married and needs some cash.
Well, you know, and that's interesting. Some celebrities say, all right, we're going to be harassed by photographers until we release photos of our new child. And they do say, we're going to donate the proceeds to charity. So they say, all right, we'll sell off the rights to show our baby and then we'll, you know, give the funds to charity, and we'll hope that they'll leave us alone after that. Other celebrities have done similar things to try and to donate to this foundation or that charity. Others are like, hey, this is their whole source of income is reality TV. It's not that they're movie stars who get this money on the side. This is Kim Kardashian's big payday, stuff like this. This is how she makes her money, and she probably figures this isn't going to last for much longer. So I've got another 40 years of living to do. I got to make sure, you know, $2 million, I want to put this aside and, you know, pay for my wedding day and, you know, do all this and put it aside and invest it and have money when the fun has run out. So, but, you know, she could have done some things where she talked about, I think there were multiple wedding dresses or something that she might have shared out with other women to have their day be special. I'm not quite sure what she was talking about.
Oh, well, what Krista was saying was, hey, you know, why can't she donate, you know, the $1.5 or $1.8 million to brides who might be less fortunate than Kim Kardashian?
Oh, just the cash. I thought she was talking about multiple wedding dresses or something like that. Maybe she chose between 3 and 4. Because I was going to say, you know what, that would be a special that she could do where Kim Kardashian could swoop in and give you a wedding dress and do your wedding day, and then he'd film that for a television special or film that for a 4 or 5 part series. You know, Kim Kardashian helps, you know, zoom up your wedding. If she did it, that's how she would do it, as part of a reality show thing. Because this is her job. This is her life is her business. So unlike other celebrities where they're sort of being interfered with on their wedding day or the birth of their child, this is literally how she makes her money.
Good point. So, and actually, she lives right up the street from me, so I should, you know, that's a great idea. I'm going to, you know, go pitch that show to her. Kim Kardashian gives you a wedding dress. We'll have to come up with a better name, but
Kim Kardashian's wedding diva or wedding fairy godmother, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you want to leave us a voicemail, you can call us. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And if you want to email us, you can do so as well. We have one email, and the email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And Michael, since you're kind of feeling a little under the weather, you want me to read this one?
Please.
It starts off, hey, boxers, a couple of weeks ago, you guys talked about a movie streaming service named Zadiva. You might recall they had a service that was streaming movies into homes using actual DVDs placed in DVD players located at their headquarters.
Oh, right, right.
I was surprised you guys didn't provide any follow-up with the story that Zadiva halted its business after a federal court ruled against them. According to a story in New TV, the movie studios sued them in an effort to shut them down and succeeded. And he provides a link. At the time, you said that Zadiva was using the first sale doctrine as a way of getting around having to purchase streaming rights. I guess the courts didn't buy their argument that they were just providing a DVD player with a really long cord. Even though I think you dropped the ball on this one, I love the show. Russell from Bellingham, Washington.
Well, thanks for writing in, Russell. I guess we did drop the ball not doing a follow-up. I just didn't hear about it. So, you know, something slipped by us without, you know,
Well, actually, I did see this story and I was thinking, you know what? We already know that this is not going to fly. We already know that this is going to be. And sure enough, you know, when I saw the story, I went, yeah, well, there you go. We said during the episode in which we discussed this, this will never last. And sure enough, it didn't last.
Well, I think I was saying at the time that it wouldn't last because it just seemed like a dumb business plan, not because I thought the courts would rule against them.
Yeah,
I don't think I was speaking legally. So he makes a good point that legally that didn't work, which is interesting. And I appreciate him letting us know about it.
Yeah. And in the court ruling, the judge talks about how long the cord could be. And so, you know, the joke or the funny part about that is, you know, well, what if your DVD player is across the room or upstairs and downstairs? You know, really, that first sale doctrine is for, you know, makes renting DVDs a possibility. So it allows for things like Blockbuster and Redbox and even Netflix. But the judge is saying, you know what? The copyright owners have the right to broadcast and stream their works. And in this case, effectively what the plaintiff, in this case Zadiva, is doing is broadcasting during a window when the copyright owners have other deals in place.
It's very interesting.
But that is our show for this week. Of course, you can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or in your RSS reader. And whether you want to email us or subscribe or follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/showbizsandbox, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox, you can find links to all of those ways to kind of keep in touch with us on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Now, that's also where you'll find links to all of the stories that we discussed in today's show. In our show notes for episode 116, we've already talked about how you can leave us a voicemail or send us email. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com.
Michael Giltz.
Yes, and we know who Michael Giltz is. michaelgiltz.com is Michael's website, and some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Who is that masked man?
I don't know. Who is it?
Michael Giltz.